Well, hi, friends, okay. And welcome back to Sermonsmith. This is a podcast of conversations about the craft of sermon preparation. And my name is John Chandler. And with me today is Wes Daniels. How are you, Wes?
I'm doing really well. Thank you.
Now, let me ask, because a lot of your Twitter and all that has C. Wes Daniels on it. So I take it Wes is your middle name. And
it is.
You just like to drop that first initial sometimes for sounds smart.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, it's funny. I've used my first initial in my name probably since fifth grade, at least. I remember, working on my signature as a fifth grader and having C in the beginning of it. So I don't really know why. I just thought it was kind of cool, I guess.
You have my full permission. I don't think you need it at this point, but I just want you to know. Well, Wes, tell us a little bit about you and I were just talking about this. You come from a Quaker background, and yeah. Or at least I don't know if you have a long-term Quaker background, but you are in a Quaker church now. So mm-hmm. Looking forward to hearing more about that. But why don't you tell us about the church where you minister and, you know, the role you have there where you preach?
Yeah, so I'm the pastor. Quaker lingo is released minister at Camas Friends Church, and I've been there for 5 years.
Portland, right?
Yeah, we're really close to Portland, like 10 minutes from the Portland airport, yeah. And 20 minutes from downtown. I've been a Quaker since I went to Malone College in Canton, Ohio, back when I was about 20, so about 15 years ago, was I think when I started to identify as a Quaker. But the church that I'm a part of, you know, we've been there for 5 years, and it's just a really, I think it's a pretty unique place. It's in a small town that was built around a paper mill, so it has a good sort of blue collar culture to it. But then maybe in the last 15, 20 years, there's been a lot of buildup of sort of suburbs for a lot of people who work in Portland. So there's a big, almost, if you want to call it a class division or at least economic division within Camas, where within about a mile, there you'll have a house on kind of down in the downtown area that's like $40,000 house. And then about a mile up, literally up on the hill around the lake, there are 10,000 square foot homes with elevators in them and just, you know, crazy, crazy mansions.
I'm guessing that's not where you live.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, part of being a Quaker pastor is to not live in a house with an elevator. Right. I think you know that getting into it. Yeah. So that presents, I'm teaching, I told you I'm teaching a class on poverty right now at Earlham School of Religion. So I'm really interested in the poverty, aspect of our community and really trying to engage that. So Camas has presented a really great place to kind of get our hands and feet wet with just trying to be out in the community and learning from those. You know, it's a congregation that's been there for 75 years. Some older folks who've been there a long time. We've got a lot of, we've got a good handful of younger families. We're probably about 50 or 60 people on a Sunday. It's a real, participatory church. So there's lots of different people, you know, any given day you might show up and wonder who's in charge. There's a lot of different opportunities through the worship service for people to, share. There's congregational prayer every week. Before I preach, we have the scripture read, and then basically ask sort of wondering questions. We do godly play. So we do godly play type questions like, about the text. So I'll ask whoever's there, you know, I wonder what your favorite part of the text is, or what surprises you, or where are you at in this story? And we'll have a conversation around the text before I preach. And then I'll usually preach for about 15 minutes, and then we'll have about 15 minutes of the what we call silent worship or open worship. And that's where people, if they're led, they can stand up and speak out of the silence. So that's a little flavor of Camas Friends for you.
Unlike anything I've had a conversation about before on Sermonsmith, which is why I'm excited to have the conversation. Although I will say my friend Phil Nellis, who I interviewed a while ago, who actually has, he's involved in a Baptist church up in the Seattle area, but I think they've borrowed a lot of some of the same kind of traditions.
Mm.
I have a friend who is in a Mennonite congregation, and one of the things he talked about was the immigrants and the natives, you know, and that a lot of people have been lifelong in that congregation, were lifelong Mennonites, and so they were the natives. But then you've got this renewed interest in that expression, and so you've got more and more immigrants coming. Are most of the people who are part of your church, would they be native, or are you finding that there's this quote-unquote immigrant Quaker population?
Yeah, yes, there's in our lingo, it's being a convinced friend is someone who comes in later in life and they're sort of convinced that they want to be a Quaker. We have a pretty good, at this point, I don't know if it's half and half, but it's really, well spread out, people who have grown up in the Quaker church or who have been Quakers for a long time, and then people who are within the last 6 months to 10 years who have become Quakers. And, you know, one of the interesting things that, Camus friends, a lot of Quaker churches don't have pastors and they meet in silence for an hour on Sunday. And that's kind of how the tradition started, was no pastor, no paid clergy, and anyone who was led to speak out of the silence could do so. And then in the 1850s or so, some Quakers broke off and started having pastors to do discipleship and biblical teaching and that sort of thing. And so you have that kind of split. And then, with the churches that have had pastors, they have traditionally moved more towards evangelicalism. And as a result of that, or kind of paralleling that movement toward evangelicalism, they've often, though not always, but have often, distance themselves from the Quaker tradition, you know, so they might start identifying themselves more as evangelicals and might not really know anything about, Quaker history, might not know, you know, or might not be a part of a church that's committed to that sort of, historic peace tradition or the, you know, the other practices that have tended to be a part of, Quakerism. But with Camus friends, they'd followed that same trajectory and were a pretty evangelical, church, you know, kind of a community church, didn't really have, if you showed up, you wouldn't know that you were in a Quaker church at all. And then about, 12 years ago or so, they made a conscious effort to start to move back towards the tradition. And as, you know, as people who'd been there for a really long time and some of the younger folks, they just decided that, they felt like they had gotten so far away from their roots that they wanted to move back. And so I think this is really fascinating, you know, to come in, when I came in and to see this church over the course of 10, 12 years, make a pretty radical adjustment in the direction that it was going. You know, a lot of times we think all older congregations, they can never change. They can never, you know, they're stuck in their old ways. They don't, you know, and this church has just done, an incredible job, moving back towards having silent worship in its, you know, in during worship time. And, they had a female pastor for the 6 years before I came, and she did a lot around practicing listening and consensus building and discernment and all these things that you associate with Quakers. And oddly enough, people start showing up and are actually interested in a church that has roots, that has an identity, and that talks about its tradition. So, and since I've been here, you know, we felt like there's a lot of things we can't be in Camus, but we can be the Quakers. You know, that's something we should be able to do well in Camus.
Yeah.
And so we've really tried to hold that up. And you know, not like as a church growth strategy or something, but, you know, this is who we are. These are the types of things we do, types of things we care about. And people are drawn to that. There are, convinced friends, you know, there are immigrants, as you said, you know, that are interested in joining that. So I think that's the reason why I say that is sort of a long way around is I think there can be a tendency to think, what we need to do in order to find, you know, new people or to build new relationships is to get away from those roots. When in fact, at least in our instance, it's going the other direction that has really helped us to become vital again.
Yeah. So you've started to even move toward this answer to the question I'm about to ask, but I'll just ask it and you can fill it in the rest of the way, which is a common question I like to ask is, what is the role of preaching in the life of your congregation?
I think I'll just talk specifically about Camus Friends Church and the way that we do it, because it's going to be different wherever you're at in the Quaker world. But for us, preaching has really tended to try to open up space, open up questions. Parker Palmer has a saying that a good question or an open-ended question creates space rather than restricts space. And that's how I see preaching really is something that's trying to open up space. So that's why, you know, before I preach, we discuss the text together and I just ask questions, you know, there's no right or wrong answer. We're just sort of getting things out in the air. I end my sermon usually with, we call them queries, kind of open-ended questions, rather than with like, okay, this is what you need to go and do now. We end it with questions. So, trying to open things up more, and also trying to, I guess the other piece of that would be trying to, facilitate, participation and trying to encourage and empower other people to find their voice and speak and, you know, share from their experience.
Yeah. Which is why it's a helpful question, because everything then that you're gearing for and how you prepare for a sermon is going to be unique to so many other traditions, you know, that I've had a chance to talk to so far. So I do, particularly I wanted to interview you about your sketch notes, and we'll talk about that here briefly. But let's still do a little bit of the normal Q&A that I do, which is tell us a little bit about what, and I, you know what, even as I say this, I guess this is going to get into your sketch notes. So we'll just go with it.
That's okay.
But tell us about what your process of preparing a sermon looks like. You know, do you use a lectionary or how do you guys determine what it is that you're going to talk about each week?
Yeah, I do use the lectionary. That's pretty unusual for a Quaker pastor. Not completely unique. I have a few other Quaker pastors will sometimes collaborate around the lectionary. And we'll call ourselves the Quaker lectionary rebels.
Quaker rebels really get out of hand.
That's right. You know, you're a rebel if you use the lectionary in my tradition. So I like using the lectionary. And I'll often, you know, look down through and see, I also like to stick in books a lot. So, you know, the lectionary is coming up. It's going to go through Philippians, sorry. So, you know, I sort of scheduled out, okay, I'm going to follow all of the Philippians passages, you know, so that I can kind of stick in one place for a little while, but while following the lectionary. So I don't always do that. Sometimes, you know, if something's coming up and there's another issue that needs to be developed. We just recently did appreciative inquiry. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Nope.
It's a change process based on comes out of sociology, but basically you ask, you ask questions around what's most life-giving within a community. And there's a set of questions and a little bit of a process around it. And so we started doing appreciative inquiry last November, and have been going through these questions and formulating them and boiling them down into kind of key themes that we see within our community where there's a lot of life, where we see God moving. And so back in the spring, I did sermons around these themes, and, you know, developed those more. So it really depends on sort of what we're doing. I like having some structure. I guess my process is, it's not too, crazy or anything. I usually will read the text on Monday, either Sunday or Monday. I'll print it out and start reading it. Meditatively, you know, sort of Lectio Divina style. And I like to,
you print it out just so you can scribble and scroll.
Yeah. I print it out and then, you know, and as I'm doing sort of meditative reading around the text, I'll, you know, words inevitably jump out at you, you know, phrases, it makes you think of something else. And so I write on the piece of paper, you know, circle words, underline things, take notes. And I do that for a little while. You know, I'm kind of asking myself the questions that I ask everyone on Sunday. What stands out to you? What's surprising? You know, where do you see yourself in the story? What's most challenging to you? You know, I ask myself those questions. And I listen for where God's at in this. You know, sometimes you read a text and it's like, okay, God, where does this, what does this have to do with Camus Friends this week? You know, so there's that. And do you want me to keep going?
Yeah, no, that's great.
Okay. I will often, consult, you know, different books. One of the nice things about using the lectionary, as I'm sure you're well aware of, are there's lots of resources online, like Text Week and Working Preacher and those sorts of things. So I, you know, at some point, Tuesday or Wednesday, I'll look for that sort of stuff, you know, some, what other people are thinking about it. I consult different books and, you know, things like that.
Favorite commentary series or what kind of resources?
You know, I do use commentaries a little bit, but I tend to be more, I guess I tend to like theology a little bit more, biblical studies that are doing more than just getting down into the Greek. If there's a word that pops up and I'm like, okay, what, you know, I know that there's something going on with this Greek word, or, you know, I need to get into it more. I have resources to do that, but I tend to be more like interested in like, okay, what do the liberation theologians say about this? You know, yeah. Or what does my favorite, theologian over here have to say? Or, you know, often if I'm reading, you know, I'm reading Parker Palmer, A Hidden Wholeness, I'm going to incorporate that stuff into it. It's just going to weave its way in. So I use Evernote, you know, to keep track of all my, ideas and, you know, if I've come across other things that are inspiring. And then, you know, I take my notes in there.
So is that
and just dump stuff from blog posts and.
So you use that both. You use that both just for capturing ideas for what might be this week's sermon, as well as just an ongoing collection, I take it. Or are you just talking about you capture stuff that you might run across for this particular week's sermon in Evernote? It's not like you keep this long form catalog of all the ideas that are coming to mind.
I do both. Okay. Yeah. I use it for all kinds of stuff.
Do you feel like you use Evernote well?
I do now, actually. I use it for a little while and I was like, I can't figure this thing out. You know, like it was above my pay grade, as one of my friends likes to say. But then I got back into it. Actually, I think J.R. Roscoe, he gave me like a free year to premium Evernote because he's like, I don't use it. Here you go. And so then I started using it and I figured it out. I mean, I figured it out for myself anyways. And I've got a fairly elaborate system that works really well for me.
Great. Because I have so many conversations with people, particularly about Evernote on here, that just say, yeah, Evernote's great. I don't feel like I fully take advantage of it, but, you know, and they just sense more possibility for it. So it's nice to hear somebody feeling the other way. Like, I feel like I've got a good system, so...
Yeah, I wish, I mean, maybe I could send you a screenshot or something of some of it. I mean, you know, like, okay, I teach at George Fox Seminary. I teach at Earlham School of Religion. So I've got a folder for teaching and all my different classes go in there, you know, and any, when I'm working on the course schedule and notes and I find blog posts or audio or movies, it all goes in there, you know, and then when I'm working on my lectures, I open up that little folder and I pull stuff out. And then I do a lot of traveling in ministry. So I have a public ministry folder for that and all my public ministry stuff goes in there. So if I'm working on a talk for American Friends Service Committee, I've got a folder there, you know, I'm doing different publishing things. So there's a folder there and all the different books or blogs or whatever go in there. And yeah, I don't know. It makes sense. A couple years ago, actually, the sketchnoting thing, I realized, this might sound sort of silly, but I realized that growing up, I was very much a visual learner, very artistic. I was the kid who was always drawing. You know, I tried to be the best artist in class, that sort of thing, and would get in rivals with other kids in my class who are, you know, they might have been better than me. You know, we go head to head and that sort of thing. And then, of course, in college, that all just goes out the window, or at least it did for me. And I'm just like, you know, taking regular notes, just handwriting notes and that sort of thing, and really got away from any kind of visual processing. And a couple years ago, I started getting back into it. And I don't remember how that all started, but there's a couple different pieces that sort of played into it. And with Evernote specifically, I drew out, I mean, with pictures, like the different areas of my life that I'm sort of responsible for or working on, and started to categorize using images, like kind of how would I organize all this stuff together? And that, once I did that, then I was like, I just basically build a database that matched that with an Evernote, and it's completely made sense to me. It might be more than other people want to invest in, you know, in terms of time and stuff, but it worked for me.
What's that? So let me backtrack a little bit and talk a little bit about the idea of sketchnotes. I think a lot of people are probably familiar with like mind mapping.
Yes.
But sketchnotes, even from what I've seen and understand, really takes it to a new level beyond that. So you want to talk about how you would define sketchnotes?
Yeah. So I'm certainly, you know, I'm an amateur when it comes to sketchnotes. There's, if you get onto Twitter, you can find like Mike Rohde, there's a number of other people who are doing really good sketchnoting. I'm trying to think. Suni Brown is another one. She's got a good book on sketchnotes and that sort of thing. But for me, really, it's trying to distill down into a really super simple image, a doodle, a complex idea. So rather than writing out a huge quote, or, you know, if I were to go and listen to a preacher, you know, rather than trying to do word for word everything that person said, I might try to capture the main idea, the big picture, with an image, and then include in words and phrases and quotes and things like that around it, but that it's image heavy, and even the notes themselves become a sort of, I mean, you've seen some of them, I'm sure, you know, they have a, they look different. They don't look like notes, you know, so there's a way that you can, at least for me, it's easier to recall, where things are at, because the way the notes are sort of laid out differently, and there's the images and quotes and, you know, big words and little words and arrows and those sorts of things. And like I quoted Parker Palmer earlier about the open-ended questions, and that was originally that's from his book A Hidden Wholeness, and I did some sketch notes on there. And when I imagine where I wrote that, you know, and on that piece of paper the first time I took those notes.
You can still see it.
Yeah. That's how I, you know, so for me it's really helpful, because otherwise, like, I just forget stuff like crazy. I mean, you know, I've got, when I was at Fuller, I've got documents just full of me transcribing professors, and I remember so little of it. But since I've started sketchnoting, things have stuck so much better. So it's good. It's not, you know, it's not something you should do just for preaching. When I sit down and I read a book and I know it's a book I want to be able to remember and hang on to, I have my notebook with me, and I follow along, and I make pictures and I write little phrases, and, you know, so.
And the one thing I would say that I've heard the argument for about sketch notes, and this is a good word for me and probably many, is the whole idea of sketch notes is not just that you were that kid who was always doodling, although in your case that was true. Mm-hmm. You know, it's something that can be a really effective way for capturing ideas and notating ideas, whether you have great looking little doodles or not. You know, it's more the visual structure of it and how you're putting things on the page. Yours would probably look a lot better than mine, but it's not just about making it look nice. Obviously.
It's not. That's not even really right. That's not really the point. The point is to have something that's visual notes. If you've seen mine on my website or wherever, I mean, they're not fancy. You know, I mean, I'm trying to just keep them simple because, you know, I mean, you don't have a lot of time in a week if you're reading or you're reading a book or whatever to, you know, it's like if I have an hour to read and I'm going to do sketch notes with it, that's going to definitely cut into the amount of time I have to actually read the text. So, you know, I try to keep it really simple. If you can draw a stick figure, you can sketch note.
Well, I'm challenged there.
If you struggle with a stick figure, then we might have to have you come to a boot camp or something.
So particularly related to, I mean, I know, and I'll link to the, you wrote a blog post that I will link to in the show notes on sermonsmith.com for this, but you, and actually I already linked to that blog post a couple days ago, but I'll link to it again. You talk about how you basically take a notebook with sketch notes up to, you know, preach, and that's what you preach from. Is your entire sermon prep process really involved with creating that particular page of sketch notes, or do you find that you do a sketch notes of what the sermon's going to look like that becomes a rough draft, and then you turn the page and you do a whole nother sketch notes of how it's finally coming together?
I may have misled you if I don't usually preach from a sketch note.
Oh, actually. I might have misread that part.
Yeah, I preach typically from a manuscript, although I have spoken from sketch notes. And I don't know, you've probably had, since you've talked to all sorts of preachers, one of my hangups is like, if I'm going to talk to a large group of people, it'll probably be a sketch note that I'm working from. If I'm going to preach to that same group of people, it's probably going to be a manuscript. And it's a hang up I have that I have a hard time switching from one to the other for some reason. But usually the process, is reading, reflecting on the text, taking some notes from other books, and the process of taking the notes from other books is where the sketch notes start to form.
Yeah.
So I'm quoting from, Dorothy Soella or, you know, James Allison or something like that. And that the text there or their images I might use as the images within the sketch note. And then usually, so usually there is some kind of a draft sketch notes that that's how I've organized my ideas. And I sit back and I can look and I can say, okay, what are the main images here? You know, like, I mean, for me, I realized, another thing why this has been helpful for me, is that I realized that my sermons were really, they could be really heady, you know. I mean, it's really easy to have them be very, nonverbal, or not nonverbal, I'm sorry, you know, very linguistically heavy and not have a lot of images. And so I have, through sketchnoting, I've really had to force myself to think in images. And then that plays itself out in the sermon. You know, usually there's an overriding image that follows through, goes through the whole sermon, or I will end with a key image. I like to end with some kind of an image often, or the sermon is in three images. And that's how I see the parts, you know, three pictures. And then when I'm preaching it, you know, I'm describing those images. I'm describing the story that captures that image or whatever. So I will then type it out and type. I need to write because it helps me to sort of formulate what it is I'm thinking. And then if there's time, I will go back and I might do a tighter sketch note, that, you know, takes in whatever came out of the writing part of that process.
One of the things that I always try to get at, sometimes well and sometimes not at all, as I'm talking to people, is how do you put together your ideas? You know, how does this sermon coalesce? How do all these scattered thoughts coalesce into this one structured sermon? And I think we've all experienced the times where they don't. Certainly the times where we know they do, and that works really well. So tell me if this is fair to say, because I wonder if what happens for you is, as you're doing your sketch notes, it really helps you structure all of the ideas, but you still have to turn to the written out, you know, manuscript part of it, because that helps you build out those ideas more fully.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is that a safe way to say it?
Yeah. Yeah. And the you know, if there's a skeleton that I'm, you know, putting things on, it's, you know, it's that more narrative sort of style of, you know, there's a question, there's a problem, you know, sort of thing. What's the main question here? And then what's usually that is the first part, you know, and then usually the middle part is the biblical text, and how the biblical text sheds light on this problem in some way. And then the third part is, some kind of an image or a story that tries to open up where we fit into, how do we participate in what's happening. I mean, that's probably, you know, if I had to say like the skeleton of it, that might be what it looks like from underneath.
Yeah. So, I mean, would you almost say, would that almost be what you would recommend? You know, I think about the first homiletics class I took all those years ago, you know, and they started us out with, you know, the basic, here's a 3-point outline, introduction, 3 points, and conclusion, which, you know, is not a bad thing at all. It's a helpful structure to think through. So would you almost say what you just described, or would you describe something different? If somebody was saying, I want to get started playing around with these sketch notes as a way to start to form my sermon, is that a structure you would recommend, or where would you say to start?
Yeah. I mean, I don't really do the 3 points type thing. Yeah. I guess there's probably three parts, you know, sort of a opening, middle, and an end, you know, the sort of the climax type thing. And I'm trying to sort of build contrast a lot of times. Are you familiar with Nancy Duarte, and her book Resonate?
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah. Yeah. So like, I mean, I guess if I aspire to sort of be like anyone in terms of, you know, that I'm trying to do her stuff, from that angle. And then I'm like laying sketch notes over top of it, or vice versa, however that might work. I would say if you wanted to start sketchnoting, I would not try to impose any kind of structure on it. You know, if we wanted to read, you know, if we wanted to read, you know, any given biblical text, Matthew 25, you know, the sheep and the goats, you know, let's read it. Let's read over it a few times. Okay. What are the key images that are popping out, you know, and let's draw some images around that. What are some words? Then let's look at, you know, let's look at some outside sources and see what other people have said about it and incorporate that into your sketch note. And it doesn't have to be, you know, the initial sketch note doesn't really have to be organized necessarily. You know, you're trying to sort of pull out those things that really jump out at you for one reason or another, you know, where's the life out in this text and in these stories that you're hearing, and then you have this kind of collection on paper of images and boiled down thoughts, and then you can say, okay, what's the flow here? Where does this go? And a lot of times you're not going to use some of that stuff. You might only use one key image or one key idea from that when you move on to writing. I wouldn't try to press you to try to get it organized to begin with.
Right.
It would be organized in the sense of most sketch notes have a kind of pattern they follow. So you might, by that I mean, like, you might, like, your piece of paper could be, you could go from left to right like you normally would, and that would be how you draw your images, you know, or you might go up and down, or I should say you like write like column type style. You know, sometimes you do more of a circular kind of a swirl around the page. I mean, so there is a structure that way, a pattern, but, that's what I would be focused on more is that, not, you know, sort of the flow of the sermon in the beginning.
So one specific question, and I might be the only one who cares about this stuff, but I get really nerdy about this kind of stuff. What kind of notebooks do you like to use?
Usually, for my sermons, I use printer paper and a Uniball Vision Elite.
Yeah, I was going to get to pen next. Yeah.
You know, so something really simple and not expensive. I do actually, I've been using a Baron Fig notebook.
Yeah.
And I do a lot, any kind of note taking that I take for myself. I don't do my sermons in here really, but if I am listening to a speaker or reading a book or doing some kind of a talk somewhere else, I will do the sketch notes in that notebook. And it's a really great notebook actually.
Yeah.
Well,
we'll start winding down, but maybe one or two more questions here for you. One of my standard questions is you've mentioned a few, certainly, but what are a few resources or books that you think would be particularly helpful for others that have formed you in your own preaching process? They might be preaching books. They might not be. That's okay. Mm. You know, you've mentioned a couple of the Sketch Notes books and A Hidden Wholeness and Resonate by Nancy Duarte. I got all those, but any others?
Yeah. Yeah, those are all pretty big for me. Another book that has been really, but probably, I don't know if it's helped my, I think it has helped my preaching. Their theology and New Testament or biblical studies books, but the Wes Howard Brook, Come Out My People, is basically, it's from Orbis. It came out a couple years ago. And it's like it's a commentary on the whole Bible. Although I don't know that he would necessarily describe it that way, but basically he's sort of looking at places, he kind of argues that the Bible is made up of stories, basically a religion of empire and a religion of creation that are essentially sort of battling each other throughout the biblical story. Hmm. And it has been so much help for me in terms of framing the biblical text and kind of looking for, okay, is this the religion of creation that's sort of at play here? And, you know, he goes in to describe the sort of the criteria, kind of what that looks like. And then, you know, or is this the religion of empire? What's at stake here for that? So that book, is one that I'm constantly going back to and looking at and drawing things out of. And James Allison's Raising Abel, which is like from like 96 or 97, is another one that's been really important for me in terms of thinking about, how we tell the story how we tell the gospel story. And he looks at it from, don't want to get too technical, but he looks at it from like a mimetic theory perspective and kind of rivalry and the need to constantly create a scapegoat to relieve tension between two warring parties, and sort of how this all plays out within scripture and especially the story of Jesus, and does it in a way that helps to, I think, really challenge some of our ideas around that make God out to be a violent God. So I don't know if I like, those are two texts that have been really important for me and have helped me to be able to articulate from the pulpit a theology that I feel really good about, you know, that connects with my own experience of who Christ is.
Sounds like as you talk about those, and going back to what you said earlier, even when we talked about commentaries, most of the time you're much more interested in framing a text into its larger place in the biblical story than zoning down into the minute details of it. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, I don't know that I observed that about myself, but I think that that's probably true. Yeah.
Well, Wes, that's all helpful. Thank you so much.
If
anybody's curious, I've written down Mike Rohde here, who I was familiar with, and Suni Brown, who I was familiar with. And I'm going to also link to your article on Sketchnotes. But if people want to keep up with other things happening with you, you know, what's your church's website? Do you have a website, your Twitter, all of those?
Yeah. Gatheringinlight.com is my website. And I was going to tell you, I'll send you a link to, I did a bunch of sketch notes for Parker Palmer's A Hidden Wholeness.
Yeah.
So if people probably have some Parker Palmer fans out there, you might enjoy looking at those.
And the Twitter. Only people who aren't Parker Palmer fans are people who haven't read Parker Palmer.
That's my right. I'll buy into that theory. At camusfriends.org, you can get on there and see what we're doing there. And I'm on Twitter too, CW Daniels.
There it is. Got the C in there.
That's right.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Wes. Appreciate
Thank you, John.
You taking the time
today. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Yeah. Blessings.